This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 12th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On Monday, The Washington Post published a trove of documents containing interviews with more than 400 officials who had been involved with the U.S. war in Afghanistan since it began 18 years ago. After a three-year legal fight, the Post won the release of the documents, which were compiled during a project called Lessons Learned, run by the Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. The Afghanistan papers reveal the extent to which the U.S. government has lied about the war and mismanaged the rebuilding of Afghan society. As Douglas Lute, an Army general who served as the White House's Afghan war czar during the Bush and Obama administrations, told interviewers, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing." Nonetheless, the administration, along with generals and other high-ranking military officials, insisted in public that the U.S. was making progress. General Stanley McChrystal, the former commander of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, had this to say in a 2010 PBS NewsHour interview.
"As we sit here now, is the U.S., along with its allies, winning the war in Afghanistan?"
"Well, I think that in the last year, we've made a lot of progress. I think I'd be prepared to say nobody is winning at this point, where the insurgents, I think, felt that they had momentum a year ago, felt that they were making clear progress. I think that's stopped."
Dexter Filkins joins me to discuss the lost lessons from the Pentagon Papers, what he learned as a reporter in Afghanistan, and what the Afghanistan Papers reveal about the politics of war in the 21st century. Dexter, welcome back.
Hi.
Vietnam, which lasted a decade, was called America's longest war. But U.S. involvement in Afghanistan has long surpassed that. You called your 2008 book about Iraq and Afghanistan The Forever War. Tell us about that.
It's funny. I remember my book came out in 2008, and I made a trip back to Baghdad just as General Petraeus was finishing up The Surge. And he kind of chided me for the title.
I'll bet he did.
The Forever War? That was 11 years ago. We're still at it.
So what did you literally mean the Forever War? I mean, at this point, it does feel as though we will never extract ourselves from this.
It certainly felt that way, and it feels that way. How do we? And that is the question we were confronting in 2008, and it's the question that we're confronting now. We're still in both countries. And I think that the really terrible thing about going back and reading all these interviews, these very frank, often shockingly frank interviews with American officials, is that we're kind of still at the same place, which is the moment we leave, it all comes apart. So what's it all been for? $1 trillion and 2,000 American lives.
As you've been reading through these papers, it must have brought back some of your experiences as a reporter in Afghanistan. What are some of the moments that have stuck with you?
I mean, there's lots of Rumsfeld in these documents. And I remember, for instance, Donald Rumsfeld flew into Kabul. This is when the war was going pretty well. This was early on, 2002.
And this was under the Bush administration.
But it was going so well, there was no questioning the kind of magnificence of the enterprise. And I remember asking a kind of a pointed and direct question, but a completely reasonable one. And he almost tore my head off. I could tell the veins were coming out of his forehead, and I thought he was going to reach across the lectern to grab me.
He said something about young man.
Young man.
And you're no longer a young man.
It was a long time ago. but that was the point. I mean, the point is anyone who followed the war, whether you were on the ground or you just read the paper every day, it was pretty clear in Afghanistan that things were, after 2002, after 2003, when we pulled everybody out to go to Iraq, things weren't going that well, and they got progressively worse. And yet, we had this kind of constant, steady drumbeat of upbeat and optimistic statements and kind of, again, scorn for anyone who said otherwise, both in the Bush administration and the Obama administration, and now in the Trump administration, where just the other day, President Trump went there and promised, victory on the battlefield to the troops.
So in 1971, after Daniel Ellsberg turned over the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, Americans learned that the Johnson administration had systematically lied to Congress and the American people about the war. Many pieces have been written this week already, and there will be many more, about the similarities between the two wars and the sudden disclosures about them. How apt do you find the comparison, though?
Very, 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 very apt. For me, the kind of the Vietnam analogy never really worked in Iraq because the wars were kind of too different. But in Afghanistan, the parallels are eerily similar. But for me, it's the similarities in these two disclosures are remarkably similar. In 1971, basically after years and years and years of the Johnson administration telling and the Nixon administration telling people that, you know, daylight is, you know, just up ahead and victory is around the corner, they find out that everybody in the government knew completely the opposite for years, you know, and it's in some ways it's gratifying because it was so frustrating at times to be a reporter in these countries because you could see what was happening on the ground and then you would ask a completely reasonable question and you would often get a surreal answer. And so it's gratifying in some ways to read these comments because you see, well, he's not the lunatic that I thought he was, you know, back in.
Just a liar, a shameless
just
liar.
Just a liar. And there's a couple of perfect examples like where you could never win in Afghanistan. I mean, as somebody who is trying to get a truthful answer out of, you know, the command or the State Department or whoever it was. But you'd say, look, there was a series of suicide bombings in the capital. Doesn't that mean the Taliban can strike wherever they want? No, it shows their desperation. It shows that they're afraid to fight the Americans. American casualty rates are going up. The death rates are going up. More Americans are dying. That's because we're fighting in areas we've never been before. You couldn't win. It was just as there's a wonderful quote in one of the documents from Jeff Eggers, who was one of McChrystal's aides, and then I think later was on the NSC staff. He said it was a self-licking ice cream cone.
So at the start of the war, what did the U.S. imagine victory in Afghanistan would look like?
Well, I think one of the things that the documents make clear is, or the interviews make clear, is that nobody really knew what it meant. There's some quotes in there. I think Doug Lute is among them, the Obama's and Bush's advisor. There was no idea what victory was. But I think it's clear, and it should be clear to pretty much anybody that has thought at all about the war, is that the goal is pretty simple in its essence. We destroyed the Afghan state after 9/11. The goal was to build something that could outlast our presence, something that could stand on its own. You know, whether that was like an authoritarian thing or a democracy or whatever.
And
that
so was it was nation building despite...
Totally, totally nation building. And the fundamental conclusion today in 2019 is that the thing we have built could not possibly stand on its own.
So a decade ago, when McChrystal assumed command of the war, he championed a counterinsurgency doctrine. The basis of that, as I understand it, was his promise to win the allegiance of the population by protecting it. What went wrong?
Well, there's a it's interesting because reading through the documents, there's a lot of different opinions about what went wrong. And one of the frustrations that one of the people being interviewed shared was that President Obama agreed to a kind of surge in troop levels in order to push the insurgency back. But he set a timeline on it right away and said, we're only going to do this for, I don't remember off the top of my head, 18 months. And then we're done. And the officer who was being interviewed said, we basically telegraphed to the enemy like we're leaving. So just hang on for 18 months and then we're out of there. But what went wrong, I think, fundamentally in that particular period, and this is sort of 2008, 2009, 2010, which was a really critical period in the war. It's the last time really when I think the American government believed it still had a chance. By 2009, at least for me, it was utterly clear that the real enemy was not so much the Taliban, but the real enemy was the Afghan government that we had constructed. It was
Who was running the government at that time?
Hamid Karzai. The Americans have this kind of wonderful acronym, as they have for almost everything, and it's VICE, V-I-C-E, and that stands for Vertically Integrated Criminal Enterprise. And that's what they called the Afghan government, a vertically integrated criminal enterprise. So there were no illusions. The Afghan government that we had created was so extortionist and so brutal to its own people that it was essentially driving people towards the Taliban. And that was the thing that we had created. So you could have a surge in American troop levels and they could kill as many Taliban, you know, every day as they possibly could. And God knows they killed a lot of them. But it didn't really matter at the end of the day, because what we were fighting for, what we were fighting on behalf of, was indefensible.
And at the same time, it seems one of the problems has consistently been the lack of human intelligence on the ground. So these generals didn't seem to understand not only the rampant corruption within the government, but the tribal governing structures, Islamic law, you name it. They just didn't understand what they were working with.
Yeah, well, there is that wonderful snowflake from that you know, handwritten note from Rumsfeld in which he says, "I don't know who the enemy is." And there's a number of those references through these documents where they're saying, "My troops were asking me, who's the enemy here?" And I couldn't tell them. I didn't know. Is it Al-Qaeda? Is it the Taliban? Is it the people? Is it the corrupt officials? What's our mission here?
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
In 2010, Obama replaced McChrystal with General David Petraeus. And I believe that over the years, you've spoken to both of them.
Yes.
And to many others who've been charged with overseeing the war. Did any of them betray any of the pessimism and despair that they reveal in these papers?
The short answer is no. But the only one who did, I think really for me consistently, was Ryan Crocker, who was the ambassador there. Crocker was saying he's America's best diplomat, in my opinion. He's amazing. If you asked Crocker in his office privately, "How's it going?" In his very frank way, he would say, "It's not going well." That was really at odds with everything you got, certainly from the generals. They were always making progress, always.
The costs of this war have been so staggering. It's worth just reviewing a couple of the numbers. So since 2001, about 2,300 American service members have died. Another 21,000 have been wounded. The U.S. government has spent or appropriated close to $1 trillion.
Yeah.
And the costs for the Afghan people have been just devastating. So more than 150,000 Afghans have died. And this past summer was the deadliest quarter on record due to an increase in Taliban suicide bombs and U.S. airstrikes ahead of the projected peace deal. So Trump has begun to draw down troops, as he had promised when he took office. And then, as you mentioned, over Thanksgiving, he went to Afghanistan and then reaffirmed that desire. What effect, though, would the drawdown have?
Well, we've been drawing down pretty steadily. I mean, I think we're down to we're just above 10,000 now. But look, I think if we went to zero, the Taliban would be in the capital within days, momentarily. They would flow in. The thing cannot stand without us. Now, many Americans might be kind of willing to say, you know what, it's done, it's lost. And, you know, I wouldn't argue. There are going to be consequences. And the biggest one, and I think the most obvious one, is women. Afghan women. And we have changed that society fundamentally. We've empowered essentially half the population that was living in more or less darkness. You know, we're going to have to reckon with that. If we leave, which we're going to leave at some point, there are going to be real consequences from that. That's half the population. And it's going to be, they're in for a very tough time. And that's on us.
Luke Mogelson was recently in Afghanistan. He wrote a piece about it. And according to his reporting, General H.R. McMaster, who was Trump's second national security advisor, resisted any peace talks with the Taliban, arguing that we should not negotiate with them while they're ascendant. But the Taliban does control about, what, almost half the country. And McMaster's long gone, and under his successors, Trump's policy in Afghanistan really has been all over the place. So he has just resumed talks with the Taliban. But what does that mean exactly?
Look, the Taliban aren't stupid. I think they know we want to leave. And I appreciate McMaster's sentiment, which is you don't sit down and negotiate with the enemy if you want to leave, if you're getting ready to leave, if you're getting ready to lose. And that's kind of where we are today. And the Taliban know that. They know we want out. They read the American papers.
So what does power sharing mean with a group of terrorists?
I don't think it means anything. I don't think it'll last. And I'm skeptical that people as smart and as capable of as Zalmay Khalilzad, who's the American envoy out there, is kind of willing to engage in the kind of play acting that he's been doing. Because without our presence there, it will fall apart. I can't imagine otherwise. It will fall apart very rapidly. And I think that the Taliban, who now basically control the countryside, will rapidly take over the cities as well.
In one of Rumsfeld's memos, this is one of the parts of the Afghanistan papers that really leapt off the page to me. In one of Rumsfeld's memos, just after the Taliban were toppled in 2002, he wrote, I remember 2002, "We are never going to get the U.S. military out of Afghanistan unless we take care to see that there is something going on that will provide the stability that will be necessary for us to leave." And then he ended by writing, "Help!"
That was 16 years ago. And he's still right. I mean, that is still the fundamental question that we're dealing with, which is how do we build something that will outlast us? And we haven't done it.
So what struck you after having read the Afghanistan papers? You know, you saw so much of this in real time.
I think the fundamental takeaway that you get from not just the Afghan war but also the Iraq war is we, the United States, we Americans, we're just not very good at this. And I don't mean fighting. I mean nation building and governing deeply foreign societies. We're just not that good at it. And, you know, we don't speak the languages. We don't know the cultures. We're not patient enough. We don't have the staying power. I'm reminded of this really vivid anecdote in a book by Rory Stewart. He's now running for mayor of London. But he, in his book, Can Intervention Work, he paints the picture of a British imperial official in Imperial India in the Raj in the 19th century. And I don't say this with any great admiration because it was an empire and it was kind of, you know, built on domination. But this imperial official, kind of a sub-viceroy, he was like a governor of a province. He spent his entire career there, 30 years. He never went home to England. He spoke all the languages, all the dialects. He knew all the tribal leaders, all the sub-tribal leaders. He was negotiating between them all the time. He dedicated his entire life to this project. We don't have people like that.
Thanks so much, Dexter.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Forever War, about the U.S. battle against Islamic fundamentalism in Afghanistan and Iraq. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.